Saving and everything for your next project now at Menards. Breathe easier with Vestair Ultimate Allergen Air Filters. They trap large airborne particles to keep allergens out of your home, and they last up to 90 days. Save big on all Vestair products at Menards and refresh your home today. View our selection of air filtration products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find great deals happening now.
A colossal monster, a city in ruins, no way out, except inside of the all-electric Toyota CHR. John Cho stars in Escape. Test drive Toyota's new all-electric family today. Toyota, let's go places.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
On July 20th, the morning jury selection began on the Lindsay Clancy trial. The prospective jurors had not yet entered the courtroom. The cameras were rolling, and before a single person was called from the pool, the prosecution was on its feet with a motion to exclude defense expert witnesses. The argument, according to Boston 25's reporting from inside the courtroom, these people aren't really experts. Kevin Reddington pushed back. He told Judge William Sullivan that one of the challenged witnesses is a doctor he consults with regularly. Sullivan allowed the motion but called it premature, saying it could be renewed at a later point. It's not a denial. That's a postponement. The motion sits open through the entire trial, and the prosecution can raise it again at any moment, including the minute before the defense expert is scheduled to take the stand. Jury selection got underway later that morning, but the motion was not the first time in the span of 11 days that the Commonwealth moved to limit who gets to speak for Lindsay Clancy's defense, who gets to put perspective, educate jurors on mental health and postpartum psychosis. It seems that Massachusetts doesn't really want an informed jury, doesn't really want an informed public. They just want their narrative, the one where she's an evil, bad, horrible person who wanted to take her children off the planet and jump out a window and ruin everyone's life. Yeah, that seems to make sense. It has nothing to do with the 13 medications that she was ramped up on, taken off of, put back on, add that one, mix this one in a little bit, take that one with a granola bar, don't take that with orange juice, have a little water with this one. Here, let's take this one back, let's add a little bit more to this. Oh, that one's not working, let's say, oh, this doctor prescribed you that? We're not going to talk to that doctor because we don't like to see what everyone's doing and have any sort of cohesive medical plan to help you through this postpartum psychosis, which we're misdiagnosing the whole time. And when shit goes horribly wrong and you end up doing what you're saying you have a fear of doing, and the medication's not working, we're going to blame you. And those experts you want to bring in, those other women who've gone through this exact same horrible thing, yeah, here in Massachusetts, that's all. That's witchery. We don't want to have those witches come in and testify. Kind of feels like it, doesn't it? It kind of feels like we might be back in witchcraft days. You know? The Salem witch trials. Witchery. Sorcery that you're bringing in, this stuff where you hear voices, that's of the devil, that's of ugh. That ain't, no, we're just gonna have these old white men tell you exactly how you feel and how this all works, and if you don't like it, well, welcome to Massachusetts, where justice doesn't really have a name because it doesn't necessarily exist in a lot of cases. We're of course talking about Duxbury, Massachusetts, where January 24th of 2023, Cora was 5, Dawson was 3, Callan was 8 months old. Their mother killed them with exercise bands in the basement of the family home. And then she cut herself and jumped out a second-story window. You know, like sane plotting people do. She survived. She's paralyzed now. She's been held without bail at Tewksbury Hospital. Lindsay Clancy has never denied doing it. Her attorney, Kevin Reddington, has conceded in an open court. She has pled not guilty to 3 counts of first-degree murder, and nobody in the courtroom is being asked to decide whether she did it. If a jury convicts her, the sentence is mandatory. Life in prison. No parole, no discretion. for the judge. If a jury finds her not criminally responsible, she goes to a locked state psychiatric hospital and gets evaluated on a schedule. And she walks free only if authorities someday decide she's not a threat. She's already said she wants to be locked away for the rest of her life. It's kind of an amazing feat when you think about this story and you think about if you yourself were in it, if you had been in a psychotic state and did that to your children, I'm kind of amazed the woman's even still alive. Because I think I might have found a way or eight to take myself off this mortal coil at this point had I done that. It's probably only because of the situation that she's in and the care that she's under that that has not happened as of yet. Not saying I'd want her to do that. Not saying that she should, but yeah. You imagine coming out of that psychotic state? Making that, my God. My God. And then saying, yeah, I was like, that was not, this is horrible. And everybody going, yes, and you should burn for it too, even though our system failed you catastrophically every step of the way. We gave you all these drugs, didn't work correctly together. And we didn't really do in our homework to make sure we were giving you the right drugs in the first place. And when we screwed up, we still blamed you. You evil woman, you, who really has no track record or history of doing anything to harm children. In fact, it's quite the opposite. You've dedicated your life and career to helping children as a neonatal nurse. But now we're a bunch of ignorant fucks that don't pay attention and don't understand psychology in any way, shape, or form and refuse to educate ourselves and just say, evil, evil woman, you. That's the case in a nutshell. In my opinion. Ignorant. Uneducated. Not wanting to face the reality that some women very readily and face in reality in such a level that, thank God, if you don't understand it, you never have to. And then everybody else over here who's either been affected by something like this directly or indirectly going, yeah, that shit's real. Why this is a question of if it's science fiction versus fact in 2026 is beyond me. It is beyond me. Yes, this exists, just like there's wind in the air that you can't see. What is that? It's not God coughing. Every fight in this trial is about one thing. Who gets to explain her mind to 18 strangers and what those strangers are allowed to hear? On July 13th, 1 week before jury selection, Reddington filed a motion to call lay witnesses at a trial. Not experts, women who survived postpartum psychosis and heard command voices telling them to hurt their own children. He argued that a woman who lived through it could tell a jury what a command hallucination actually feels like from the inside. Prosecutors objected, you know, because we don't want, you know, people to have context or understanding from other real human beings. They argued on two grounds. First, the motion was a discovery violation. According to Court TV's report, Reddington identified the proposed witnesses only by initials with no witness statements and no detail about what they would say. Second, Assistant District Attorney Jennifer Sprague argued that allowing them would open the door to women who suffered the same illness and did not do this to their children. The ones who locked themselves in a room, the ones who got in a car and drove away. Then it becomes a trial within a trial, she said. Sullivan denied the motion. His reasoning for Court TV, experts on both sides agree postpartum psychosis is real, and lay witnesses would have no evidence to offer that relates specifically to the Clancy case. He said he did not see what testimony they could give that expert witnesses could not already provide. That ruling is legally defensible, but what it does is specific. The only people alive who can describe a command hallucination from the inside, who can say what the voice sounds like and whether you can fight it, are now the only people in this case who don't get to speak. The jury learns about postpartum psychosis exclusively from professionals who've studied it, not from anyone who survived it. And there's a reason the prosecution has been able to strip the defense bench this way. It has to do with who carries the burden in Massachusetts. And it's the opposite of what most people assume. Before that, go back 11 days earlier, because the pattern starts with a filing that looked like mercy and was actually not. On July 9th, prosecutors filed a null prosky. I'm probably saying that wrong, my attorney friends, on three counts of strangulation. All three charges are now gone. 11 days before trial, both Stone and a spokesperson for the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office said the strangulation charges would be subsumed into the murder charges and are therefore redundant. Redundant is a legal word, and it means the same conduct is already covered by a more serious charge. On its face, dropping redundant charges is unremarkable housekeeping. Prosecutors do it routinely, and most of the time, nobody writes a story about it. But the timing matters. 11 days before trial, after years of pretrial hearings, after Reddington has built a defense around a full charge sheet, and the Boston Globe reported the move as a deliberate shift to focus the jury's attention on the murder charges alone. Because three counts of strangulation sitting alongside three counts of first-degree murder give the jury something prosecution does not want them to have options. A juror who can't bring herself to vote for life without parole might land on the strangulation conviction instead. A juror who's tormented by the evidence but cannot call this woman a murderer might find somewhere in the middle to put her conscience. Drop those charges and the middle disappears. The only verdicts left on the table are first-degree murder, life mandatory, or not criminally responsible. Two doors, nothing in between them, where reality actually lives. And every conflicted juror in that room has to pick one. It's not a concession, it's architecture. The prosecution built a corridor with no exits. Three moves, 11 days, charges trimmed on July 9th to eliminate the space between the two verdicts. Lay witnesses blocked on July 13th to keep anyone who lived through the illness off the stand. Defense experts challenged on the morning of July 20th before a single juror was seated. Every one of those moves points the same direction. The Commonwealth is narrowing who gets to explain this woman's mind and what that jury is allowed to hear about it. Massachusetts calls it lack of criminal responsibility. Once evidence of insanity is introduced, the burden flips. The Commonwealth has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Lindsay Clancy was criminally responsible. That means proving she had substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of what she did or to conform her conduct to the law. Reddington does not have to prove she was sick. Plymouth District Attorney Timothy Cruz's office has to prove she could have stopped. That burden is precisely why the prosecution can afford to play this kind of game on the offense. When you're the side that has to prove something, you need to control what the jury hears. Every witness who gets blocked is one fewer voice complicating your proof. Every expert who gets challenged is one fewer opinion the jury has to weigh against yours. Those icky, intrusive thoughts. Those other opinions, other voices, education on the matter. Why would we want informed jurors? Who wants that? Every charge that gets trimmed is one fewer place a juror can land. That isn't your verdict. The prosecution is not breaking any rules. It is managing the landscape within the rules of what it can do. And Reddington knows it. At the July 13th hearing, he asked Sullivan to add an instruction before defense opening tells the jury that the burden of proof sits on the Commonwealth, not the defense. He told the court, it's not the defendant's burden to prove she lacked criminal responsibility, but the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was not acting as a result of mental disease or defect. Prosecutors objected. Sprague argued it would be inappropriate to mention any affirmative defense regarding insanity before either expert testimony or the defendant herself formally makes the claim. Sullivan did not grant it. So the jury walks into the trial not knowing the burden is reversed. The jurors will learn it eventually, but the prosecution gets to build its case first in the order it chooses with the witnesses it selects before anyone explains the rule that says they are the ones who have to prove something. Reddington asked the judge to tell the jury the rules before the game started. The prosecution said, let us play first, and then judge, and the judge let them. Let's play a game. We're not going to tell you the rules or how you have to evaluate this stuff until after the fact. That sounds fair and smart. You guys do this really well in Massachusetts. At the same hearing, Reddington asked for the jury to be sequestered, citing extensive pretrial publicity. He had already tried to move the trial from Plymouth to Boston and had been denied. Sullivan denied sequestration as well, saying he would ask prospective jurors about their exposure and instruct them daily to avoid media coverage and social media. Sullivan also confirmed that he plans to seat 18 jurors instead of the standard 12, plus four alternatives, 12 deliberating, six alternatives. Reddington told Court TV that in his decades of trying cases, he's never had 18. Sullivan, he said, obviously recognizes the unusual nature of this one. So as jury selection moves forward, here's what Reddington has left to work with. His own expert witnesses, assuming they survive the prosecution's challenge, which Sullivan left open and which the Commonwealth can renew at any point. The roughly 50 witnesses on his list, most of them friends, family, and colleagues who can testify to Lindsay Clancy's behavior and her decline in the months before January 24th. Patrick Clancy, who appears on both witness lists and testifies for the defense, according to the witnesses list that was obtained by People, the civil complaint and the medication chain, his office puts at 13 drugs, the 17-minute psychiatric appointments alleged in her lawsuit. The 4 days she spent on a locked unit at McLean Hospital over a holiday weekend waiting for a doctor who didn't come until the holiday was over. Don't want to bother the doctor. What he does not have? Women who live through postpartum psychosis. Possibly his own experts, depending on emotion that hasn't been resolved. Any instruction telling the jury who carries the burden before the prosecution's case in chief is already underway. And any room on the verdict sheet between life without parole and locked hospital. Reddington told Court TV on July 13th that this is probably the most emotionally disturbing and challenging case of the decades he spent trying them. He also said he may seek permission to keep his client out of the courtroom for the worst of the testimony, including the autopsy photographs. He told reporters he doesn't understand how she's going to have the strength to sit through it. The prosecution is not doing anything illegal here. Every motion was filed within the rules. Every ruling is defensible on the law. Individually, none of these decisions is remarkable. Charges get consolidated. Lay testimony gets excluded. Expert qualifications get challenged. But the pattern is the argument. When you lay all three on the table in order, the picture is specific. This is a prosecution that understands it carries the heaviest burden in criminal law and is systematically reducing the number of voices that could give the jury reason to doubt. The strangulation charges gave jurors a place to compromise. Gone. The women who survived gave jurors a way to feel what the defense describes. Gone. The defense experts give jurors a professional opinion that contradicts the Commonwealth's doctors, under challenge on day one, with the motion parked and reloadable. By the time the jury deliberates, the version of Lindsay Clancy's mind they carry into that room will have been shaped as much by who they did not hear as by whom they did. Cora was 5 years old, Dawson was 3, Callan was 8 months old, and fought for 3 days before he died. None of the three of them gets a version of where any of it comes out okay. A courtroom full of adults spent the opening hours of this trial arguing about who gets to talk. The argument will take 4 to 8 weeks, and the children at the center of it will never say a word. You can, so use your voice in the comments section. Substack, YouTube, the links are there. If you've been through something like this, let your voice be heard, please. Help people understand what this case is about and what it's not. We'll keep doing our part as we continue to cover this. If you want to hear trial coverage, we have it for you on our podcast feeds, the audio feeds of our program. Wherever you get podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Press subscribe. That's where you get the audio version of our show every single day. That's where you can listen and keep up with the case, and we'll continue to cover it for you every step of the way, both on YouTube and on our podcast. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Now let's move on over to the defense. Reddington isn't disputing that Lindsay Clancy killed her three children. He offered to put it in writing. His entire case is that the woman who did it wasn't there, that she'd been begging for help for months, and every single person around her missed it. We're digging into the defense of Lindsay Clancy now. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, with us as always to help break down these tough cases. She told her husband at the end of December that she was having thoughts of hurting her kids. She checked herself into a psychiatric hospital on New Year's Eve. 19 days after they discharged her, her children were dead. The case should be a referendum and spotlight on our broken mental health system. But it's not. It's going after another victim of the mental health system. Will her story help people see the reality of how broken this system is? Bob, do you think? I mean, I know if people are paying attention to it closely and are objective, they will hopefully see it. Do you think this will shine a bigger light on it beyond the true crime fans who are watching this sort of thing as closely as we are?
God, I hope so. I really do. You know, it's like I've been working in the criminal justice system for decades, and my biggest frustration always in dealing with prosecutors was getting them to acknowledge, first and foremost, that mental illness is a real thing. I think if we were able to kind of calculate the crimes that are committed and put them into either one of three buckets, which is addict, mental illness or defect, or both, that 90% of crimes and the people that are committing them would fall into one of those three buckets.
Yeah.
And you know, trying to get to humanize defendants with prosecuting attorneys in this, because of the shift to where truth is not what's at stake, it's convictions, because that's what gets people elected. When that happened, and that happened long, long ago, because make no bones about it, prosecutors are elected officials. It is a political job. I'm tough on crime is always the rallying cry. And what I do to prove that is I show you my prosecutor's record is, you know, I have a 98% conviction rate. That's what they do to sell themselves, that they're tough on crime, because people want to live in safe communities.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's an easy sell for a prosecutor. I'm going to make where you live safer because I'm going to put the bad guys away. And when you have that battling with the concept of reality.
Yeah.
And the concept of that we're dealing with human beings, and every different case is its own story. Like there are no two cases are the same. It's like I was going through our live on Clancy, and a lot of people in chat, yeah, it reminds me of Andrea Yates down in Texas back in the early 2000s. I'm like, no.
they're all
different cases. They're all different circumstances.
And if you're just following it as a bumper sticker, unless you're into this stuff, that's most of the general public is a bumper sticker. It is I'm tough on crime. Well, that's great. You're tough on crime, but let's actually define what's a crime,
right?
And what's just padding the record here to show that you have another person behind bars, whether they should be or not. That's not necessarily dealing with reality. And this is one of those cases where, you know, it is not Andrea Yates. And we've seen plenty of cases where the mom should go, you know, take a flying leap off a cliff and just be gone for the monstrous shit that they've done while being sane. Ruby Frankie comes to mind. There's several others. But this is a case where Lindsay Clancy did everything right. That's what strikes me about this. This is not someone who just sat there and went, well, this is me, deal with it, and then crazy things happened. This is someone who recognized it enough to have 13 psychiatric drugs, 13 scripts, 13 different times a doctor had to go to their pad and go, oh, you should have this. And throughout those 13 times, they didn't communicate with the other doctors. It also wrote her scripts as well. That's part of the civil suit. That's a whole conversation unto itself. But this is a case where this woman exhausted all of the roads to go down, and at every single turn she was failed. Now, I don't look at these doctors and go, I'm sure you were conniving and trying to kill her and make her do crazy. No, but the system is broken the way it communicated. It could have caught itself. It did not. But because the system failed her in all those different ways, you put anybody, take postpartum psychosis out of it, take bipolar out of it, take you or me, take a person who can't be pregnant, and let's go on a cocktail of 13 different benzos, SSRIs, antipsychotics, and you name it over the course of a few months, and let's see how you're doing on the other side of it. I'm going to guess a lot like Lindsay Clancy, no matter how much you love your children or anything around you, you're not going to be thinking clearly. That just seems to be a factual piece of this case, but for some reason it's up for debate, as if that's not even a factor in this damn thing. A lot of people watching this, you know, are on something a doctor gave them. How can the state pretend that this wouldn't play a major role in her behavior, Bob?
It's a great question, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it lacks humanity for me.
It does.
You know, like that part of, you know, the white hat, which is, you know, what they consider the prosecutors to be in this country. You know, they have a duty to the citizens of this country, and to be lacking humanity in doing that job is unforgivable in my eyes. It just is.
I mean,
that's not to say that there's not great prosecutors in this country and
yeah,
good people doing the jobs, but you know, when it breaks down to the point where you're asking yourself, like, who looked at this? Like, at the end of the day, who rubber stamped this thing to try her on this case without taking into consideration what they know are facts?
Yeah.
They know exactly. They got all of her medical records. This isn't a mystery to them. They know what the background is, and they're choosing to act as if psychosis doesn't allow for a person to put a logical thought together while it's coursing through their minds. And it's disingenuous, and they know it. And they're going to go into that courtroom, and they're going to put on doctors who I'm assuming are going to be completely full of shit. Like, any doctor that's going to be testifying on behalf of the state in this trial, that it's going to get up there and say that, no, that's not possible. If you're in the state of psychosis, you can't possibly put together logical thoughts. You couldn't possibly premeditate this kind of thing, are completely full of shit, and they should lose their license to practice. Yeah.
They're the types that are on the commercials going, tell your doctor that this is right for you, where it's like, they'll take the payday, they'll do whatever they need to do. I mean, and there's shitty doctors out there like that. That's why we're in a state. And I'm not saying the doctors that were her doctors did that, but when you have expert witnesses being called and such, if you have somebody that's going to go up on the stand, there's no psychological doctor worth their weight in salt that could go up and say that someone in an active psychosis couldn't premeditate things, couldn't plan things. Look at all of the cases where we do deal with psychopaths that are premeditating shit left and right, and they're able to mingle into society and nobody's the wiser. That's how this shit works. And why this is such a mystery, I don't know. But clearly, I mean, we still have states in the union that don't even recognize an insanity defense in any capacity.
Idaho,
exactly. I mean, that and that may be shocking to some people, but it's true. We are very behind the times, to, I think, put it nicely, in our court system of what we recognize as the root cause and problems of the crimes that we face that are committed. And I don't know why we, in a case like this, she's not asking, let me be free and go live a life and love. She's like, lock me away in a mental institution for the rest of my life. I'm cool with that. They literally, in so many words, came to them and said, she's cool with that. Can't we just do this way? And the DA in the court said, nope, we're going full bore, pedal to the metal. You are an evil bitch and you must go to prison. That to me has just been baffling. Are you surprised, Bob, as a defense attorney, that this made this all the way to trial, despite the concessions that she and her team themselves have given? We know she did it. She says she did it. She's suffering horribly through all of this too. She doesn't want, she's just lock her away in a safe place, not in a prison. That's not a safe place for someone who's done this. Why was that a bridge too far for the prosecution here that we got to a trial? Are you surprised we're going to trial?
No, I'm not.
No,
that's how the system works, man. Like the system is broken. Like many of our systems in this country, the criminal justice system is broken. It's that thing that I was talking about. Like my biggest thing that I was smashing my head against a brick wall during my career was the fact that I could not get the prosecutors to acknowledge that mental illness is an actual thing and they have to take it into consideration when deciding whether or not to charge people.
Yeah.
You know, take it into consideration. Like when I was starting to wind up my practice in terms of like retiring, a prosecutor that ended up winning on, and this is not something I typically do, but she was running on the platform that she was going to acknowledge addiction and mental health in her term as prosecutor. And I was all about it. I'm like, oh my God, this is incredible. I've been waiting for this prosecutor for my entire life as a lawyer. And I'm going to stick her yard sign in my yard because I want her to win because that's how important it is. And she did win. And then she did what she said she was going to do. There is now a mental health court. Mm-hmm. And like every state, every county has to have a mental health court because it's the only way. Because there you're having social workers involved with it. There's people that are not lawyers and judges and cops and prosecutors that actually understand what's going on with people that are working to try to make people better. To help people, to help their with the mental illness, because punishment ain't it. Mm-hmm. Like throwing somebody who's mentally ill in prison is the exact opposite of what needs to be done. Like if you don't give a shit about people and crimes are black and white, oh, you committed the crime, put them away. I don't give a shit. See you later. Well, good on you. Like that's not how I live my life. I value humanity far more than that. And, you know, and I'm not going to judge people on how they think about it. But like for me, I care about humanity. Like to me, it's important. Like I see a glaring, gaping hole in the system that needs to be fixed. And there's a way to go about doing it. It just has to come about. There have to be people that are willing to do it on that side of it. And so when I started seeing it happening on a small scale, at least it gave me hope. You know what I'm saying? At least it gave me some hope. So the hope is, like you said, Tony, getting beyond the true crime fans that are going to be paying attention. Will this case resonate nationally to the extent where people that don't watch true crime will see it and they'll be like, wow, holy shit. That really makes me think. Because I'm going to tell you right now, this country and frankly, the entire world, we are teeming with mental illness.
Yes.
Like mental illness is not getting better. We are fucking filled, pardon my French, we are filled with crazy in this country. Look at the news every single day. And that's scratching the surface of the amount of crazy that is going on in this country on a daily basis. People have lost their minds.
It's the root cause of 90-some% of the cases that we talk about, 100%. And yet the court system itself treats it like it's almost non-existent in some areas. And as a majority of the country, I would say it treats it like that across the board. Its default mode is not to identify or look in that area when that is the root cause. It's almost like going to a fire. Someone's house is burning down and something going, well, clearly there's flames flying out of the house. Well, have you checked the mouse traps? Do you think the mouse traps are the problem? It's like, we're not talking about infestation of rodents. There's a house fire right here. But those mice are going to eat shit in the pantry. That's not what we're talking. And that seems to, it seems to be at this point in our history, chosen ignorance, if you will, because it's an icky topic. It is somewhat more complex and difficult to understand. It's not as black and white as we like things to be, but our society needs to step up and go, yeah, most of the cases that we discuss fall in that area. And it doesn't give anybody a pass for their crimes, but it also doesn't make everything black and white either. If we're going to fix anything, we have to identify what the actual problems are and not treat them all as the same, which it feels like they're doing here. Patrick Clancy is testifying. That's her husband. There is some ambiguity right now. The Boston Globe reporting yesterday that they're divorced. Up until this point, we thought that they were still married. I don't know the answer to that. That's what the Globe had reported. Either way, I don't think it necessarily means a whole lot. She's never going to be in a state to be out, and it's understandable why someone would divorce, but still very much stand by their wife's side, their former wife's side, if that's in fact what the title is today, because he empathizes with her. He understands what she went through. He was right there. He was closer to this than any other living person, not the DA, not the judge, not the jurors, not the justice system. He was there. He's standing by her side. He's saying he forgives her because he understands why this happened and how she was failed. How much of a not guilty, guilty verdict depends on his testimony, Bob?
I think it's huge. I think it's an absolutely huge thing. I think that him standing by her, because like you said, he had a front row seat. And not only that, I mean, he's the one making the phone calls. Like when she gets on the Seroquel, it's him, Patrick, making the phone calls to the doctor saying, I don't know what you got her on, but she's 10,000 times worse than prior to you giving it to her. And what do? They up it from 50 milligrams of Seroquel to 400 milligrams. This, like, he was actively working with her to try to get her better. Like make no bones about it. I mean, she put herself in inpatient for 5 days, it turned out to be, because she didn't know what was happening. And then like this, like when people are sitting there telling me that she was a nurse and she understands how the drug, you just don't understand mental illness. When you are the people that are saying that, well, she was a nurse, she understood, she was pill seeking. I'm like, what on God's green earth are you talking about?
Yeah, she wanted to go get hopped up on 13 different drugs.
Right,
like, that's what she was.
People that need to watch the trial, T. Like, because they just don't. They're not dealing with the reality of it. And here, before we move on to the next thing, so Patrick is huge.
Yeah.
I thought it would be very instructive. It's not super lengthy, and I'll kind of break it down. I want to read the jury instruction in terms of lack of criminal responsibility so that people going into this trial will understand where the burdens lay, who's got the burdens, and what has to be shown by the defense prima facie, meaning on the front end, before the burden shifts to the state. So it'll be good, and I'll run through it quick. So the jury instruction is called lack of criminal responsibility, which in some states is not guilty by reason of insanity. So if the Commonwealth has proved the elements of the offense by beyond a reasonable doubt. So just so you know, going into this trial, the state is still going to, even though Lindsay is admitted, everybody knows that she did the acts, they still have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So that part of the trial is going to take place. If you're wondering why, that's why, because they have to still prove it up and they have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So if those elements are proven, the Commonwealth must also prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was criminally responsible at the time of the alleged offense. Not what she's like now, not what she was like before, but on the day of, at the time of the offense. Under the law, the person is not guilty if they lacked criminal responsibility when they committed the offense. This is sometimes referred to as guilty by reason of insanity or not guilty by reason of insanity. There is no burden on the defendant to prove that they lacked criminal responsibility. the Commonwealth may meet its burden of proving a defendant was criminally responsible for their conduct in either of two ways. The first way is for the Commonwealth to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not suffer from a mental disease or defect at the time of the alleged offense. They're not going to be able to meet that burden. All right. So that one, we know from her medical records that she was definitely diagnosed with PPD and as mm-hmm. well as onset bipolar.
Yep.
So a mental disease or defect need not fit into a formal medical diagnosis. It is a legal term, not a medical term. It does not, however, include an abnormality that presents itself only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial behavior. It is for you, remember this is a jury instruction, to determine from the evidence whether the defendant had a mental disease or defect at the time of the alleged offense. The second way for the Commonwealth to prove a defendant was criminally responsible for their conduct is for the Commonwealth to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that even if the defendant suffered from a mental disease or defect at the time of the alleged offense, the defendant nonetheless retained the substantial, and this is the most important language, this is where the case is going to live. The defendant nonetheless retained the substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness or criminality of their conduct and to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. Okay, so it goes on, but that is the heart of it. That goes to the phone data. That's where the state is living. They're going mm-hmm. to say, look, she had the capacity to understand. She sent her, like their story is they sent her husband off to the furthest restaurant away, which was only a 9-minute drive.
It wasn't far. Yeah.
It wasn't far, you know, but like, that's their story. Like that she did this planning, that this is premeditated. That shows beyond a reasonable doubt that she had the substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness or criminality of mm-hmm. her conduct. A lot of states don't have that aspect of it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but Massachusetts does. And, you know, what goes on to say after that, it says to establish that the defendant had the substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness or criminality of their conduct, the Commonwealth must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant appreciated, that is, that the defendant knew or understood in some meaningful way that their conduct was either illegal or wrong. So that's where this case is going to live. This is going to be a battle of the experts. And this is where the people are going to be, well, she was Googling restaurants and like she sent them away. Like that's where those people are going to live there. They're going to be, yeah. That proves it. And that's where I'm saying we have to get the experts that are going to say, okay, take a step back, take a mm-hmm. breath. People that are in psychosis can have rational thoughts.
Yeah.
They can, but see the problem for the state is if the jury comes to believe the fact that she was having these auditory hallucinations, which are different than thoughts. So like, if you look at some of the things that she's quoted as saying, sometimes it's I when she's saying something, and sometimes it's you when it's the voice speaking to her. Mm. She's like, you are never going to get better. You have to kill yourself. You have to kill the kids in order to be able to kill yourself. Like these, like this is the voice that she's hearing. And if there's experts that are able to get people to understand that there are people that exist in this world that have mental illness wherein you cannot delineate reality from what is going on in your mind. It becomes so blurred that you have no idea what's real and what's not real.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, but it's going to be a challenge, man, because Americans just don't think that mental health and mental illness is a thing. They just don't, unless they've experienced it firsthand. Yeah.
That in itself says a lot about how rampant our mental health problems are. The fact that there is such a barrier up in so many minds to accept the reality of it, that says a lot, despite how much of it is in every single one of our lives, every single day. I think most don't even realize it half of the time. I want to go into another section here. Your thoughts on the defense and where this is going in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. Go and give us your thoughts there right now.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.